This is the Daily Radio Ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Psalms. Today, Pastor Sandy will be teaching through chapters 120 through chapter 128 in the book of Psalms.
They began to sing. Then they said among the nations, "The Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are glad." What was a dream to the Jews was also a testimony to the nations of the power of God. Even the nations took note of God's intervention. He says, "Bring back our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the south." You know, the streams in Israel's Negev, or its southern region, are seasonal. And these waterways, these wadis as they're called, they'll fill up in the rainy season, but they're dry the rest of the year. And the psalmist is here praying for God to return the Jews to Judah as the spring rains bring water back to the desert. He says, "Those who sow in tears shall reap in joy." Isn't that wonderful? God turns tears into joy. "He who continually goes forth weeping, bearing seed for sowing, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him." Notice that your tears are seeds of future joy. Whenever we mourn, whenever we shed tears, God sees those tears, but they become seeds for something new and better that he wants to do in our lives. God turns tears into joy. Well, Psalm 127 is also one of the Psalms of Ascent. It was written by David's son Solomon. This is a wonderful psalm, one of my favorites. It begins, "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it." Now, Psalm 127 was written by the master builder, the master architect, Solomon. All over Jerusalem, in fact, all over Israel, there were fortresses and there were walls and there were palaces that testified to Solomon's construction prowess. Of course, Solomon's greatest achievement was the temple in Jerusalem. He spent 7 years and wealth untold constructing the first temple in Jerusalem. And yet throughout the construction, throughout its progress, Solomon had this gnawing sense that his part in the project was in reality minor, that there was a spiritual supervisor on duty, that there was someone else calling the shots and doing the work. In reality, God was building the house through Solomon's efforts. But if God had not been part of the construction, it would have failed. Solomon admits, "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it." You know, often church leaders forget this principle. We trust in the latest gimmick or survey or method or technology rather than trusting the Lord himself to build his church. If we do anything of eternal value, God has to be involved. Yes, we have a part, but it's 0.1% compared to the part that God plays. In fact, Solomon goes further. It's not just the Lord who builds the house, but it's God who sustains what's been built. He adds, "Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain." What God builds, he's faithful to watch over and ensure its safety. And that's why we're told in verse 2, "It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep." I mean, if we're trusting God to do the work, why are we so stressed out? Why are we getting up early every morning? Why are we going to bed late at night? Why are we burning the candle on both ends? Go ahead and sleep in one morning if you're trusting God to take care of it. God can handle it. You go ahead and sleep in. God will take care of things. He can handle things. Knock off early one night if God is in control. I mean, if God's in charge of things, why not play 9 holes of golf on your way home tomorrow night? Treat yourself, okay? God has everything under control. If God is in charge, why aren't we enjoying our life more? That's the big question. I'm not suggesting we shouldn't work hard, but sometimes we do act as if it's all on our shoulders, that God has no role at all in our endeavors. How foolish. "Unless the Lord builds the house, you labor in vain who build it." Remember the Jewish priests, they were always required to wear linen garments, breathable fabrics. Why? So they wouldn't perspire. You see, a sweaty priest was a poor representative of God. Everyone should see that God's work is no sweat. Unless the Lord builds a house, they that labor, labor in vain. In verse 3, Solomon transitions from building temples to building families, from raising buildings to raising babies. He says, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward." Now, the word heritage literally means an assignment. Parents, did you know that your child is a special assignment given to you by God? Your son, your daughter is your God-given assignment. Training your child is your mission. There are not many things that you can say God has told you authoritatively, dogmatically, that this is what He wants you to do, but training your child is one of them. It's your mission. It's your assignment. And you're going to be graded on the job that you do. Parents need to treasure their kids. They need to always see their kids as a gift, as a blessing, as an opportunity, as a reward from the Lord. As one man said, children should be viewed as valuable additions, not needed deductions. And this is what many so-called Christian countries today have forgotten. Now think about how population trends work. Take two couples, four people. These two couples each have one child. These children then marry, and they have one child. All of a sudden, you've gone from a population of four to a population of one in two generations. A 1.0 growth rate shrinks the population 75% in just two generations. In fact, sociologists say that it takes a 2.11 growth rate to actually replenish a society. Less than a 1.9 is the path to extinction. Today, the 31 countries of the European Union have a combined population replacement rate of 1.38 kids per couple. That's not good. And yet, the population of Europe grows. And why? Due to the Muslim immigration. In fact, the population replacement rate in France is 1.9. But among Muslims in France, it's 8.1. Do you realize that by the year 2027, one in five Frenchmen will be Muslim? Now, I know nobody cares about France, but, it's alarming. It's estimated that by the year 2048, France will be an Islamic state. Islam will have taken over France without firing a shot, just through the immigration and the population rates. Today, in the Netherlands and in Belgium, half of all newborns are born to Muslim families. If the current growth rates and immigration policies continue, Europe will become an Islamic continent in the near future. Here's what I'm saying. Christian culture in Europe has stopped reproducing itself. And the growth rate is not much better in the United States. With our Latino population, our growth rate is 2.11. The bare minimum for sustainability. Without that demographic, there's a 1.6 growth rate. In other words, we're not reproducing enough children to maintain our way of life. And of course, the question is why? And there are numerous answers. Feminism has deceived millions of women into thinking that motherhood is a form of slavery. Rather than celebrate motherhood and children, we mock and ridicule women who choose to have large families. Good old Mother Hubbard would be anathema in our society. Today, our feminist culture teaches women that childbearing is an interruption in their right to financial independence and a career. Of course, there are other problems. Tax laws and government policies and access to abortion all contribute to the population squeeze that's occurring today in America and in Europe. Did you know that since World War II, abortion has robbed the world of 1.5 billion people? But perhaps the biggest culprit is our own selfishness and our own abandonment of the Christian worldview. We ignore the Bible. Rather than adopt a biblical attitude and view kids as God's blessing, an opportunity to pass on to a new generation, a love for God and a love for life and a love for people. Instead, we too have fallen victim of seeing children as interruptions and inconveniences. We've stopped being obedient to God's command to be fruitful and to multiply. And this is tragic, and it will have enormous consequences on our way of life. If you're married and if you're of childbearing age, get on with it. No, I'm not saying ignore wisdom in planning your family. You need to be wise. You need to think it through. But we all should celebrate and value children, and we should honor parents, not just on Mother's Day, but on every day. Solomon continues his appraisal of kids. He says, they're like arrows in the hand of a warrior. So are the children of one's youth. Children are both a reward and they are a responsibility. Understand, the bow and arrow was a breakthrough in ancient warfare. With a bow, you could now kill a foe at a distance. Beforehand, it was all just hand-to-hand combat. This new technology, though, sent the weapon on ahead. And this should be the goal of our parenting. Not just to keep kids tucked away forever in the quiver, but to send them on ahead. Hey, I want my kids to go farther and to go higher and to go straighter than I've traveled. You know, often my kids will try to cop out, you know, Dad, when you were a kid, you did. And, you know, I'm quick to squelch that stuff. I'm up front with them. I've told them from the beginning, if they don't turn out better than me, I'll be extremely disappointed. My responsibility is to aim them in the Lord's direction and then send them sailing further and higher than I've ever been. If they set their sights on me, they've shot too low. Our children are like arrows that we send out ahead that can accomplish more than we could ever dream. Of course, archery is an art. It's a skill. You know, Robin Hood makes it look easy, doesn't he? But there's a lot that goes into shooting a bow and arrow, just as there is a lot that goes into parenting a child. There's a tension on the string. The tension's got to be just right. The position of the arms and the shoulders, the release, the aim, measuring the loft and the distance. There are a lot of moving parts in archery. And if the archer is off a fraction in any of his calculations, he can miss the target by 30 feet. And the same is true with our parenting. Especially when our children are little. When they're young, that's the time when we've got to get it right. You know, if your trajectory is off when a child is young, by the teenage years, you can have a real problem on your hands. It's been said that by the time a child is 5 years old, the parents have done 50% of all they'll be able to do to affect that child's future. That means that you can't slack off after the child. You know, you can't, when the child's young, you got to stick with it. You got to be vigilant. That's the time for you to have an impact on that child's life. Of course, once they turn five, that doesn't mean you can go on vacation either. But it just means that the earlier years are the better years to make an imprint on that child's life. Perhaps you've heard of the phenom contraction. It's a phenomena. It's about the larynx, the human larynx. Apparently, a baby's born, and the larynx is very soft and very pliable. But as the child begins to learn words and begins to mimic their parents' language, the larynx hardens around the sounds that it most commonly forms. In fact, once the larynx forms around certain sounds, it's hard to retrain it to make other sounds. This is why a person's accent is hard to alter. Even when they learn a new language, they still speak it with the same accent. I mean, place a Chinese baby in your home, and he or she will end up speaking English. And not just English, but English with a southern accent. A southern accent will come out of that Chinese child. In fact, no matter how hard he tries, he'll probably never be able to learn to replicate a Chinese accent, because in those early years, the larynx is formed around those certain sounds. And this is not just true with language. It's also true with other types of behavior. As one author put it, children are wet cement. It's true. You've got just a short time to shape them and form them before their attitudes and actions harden into habits. Years ago, I read a quote by famed French scientist Louis Pasteur. Pasteur's insight has guided me in my own parenting, and after four kids, I still agree. He says, when I approach a child, he inspires in me two sentiments, tenderness for what he is and respect for what he may become. If you're a parent of a young child, that's what you've got to keep in tension. Yes, tenderness for what he is, but also respect for what he can become. Good parents are kind and tender, but they also keep an eye on the goal, and they allow just enough challenge into their child's life to build the character that they'll need later. Well, Solomon wraps up Psalm 127 in verse 5. He says, happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate. And here's the million-dollar question for parents. How many is a quiver full? And I don't think there's an answer to the question. For every quiver is a different size. Our quiver held 4. Your quiver might hold 2 or 12. And you might think it holds 2, but then God knows it can hold 3, and so that happens too, you know. But happy is a man whose quiver is full. Kathy and I have been rewarded with four times with four beautiful, wonderful children. They are our rejoicing, and they're our responsibility. And when asked to describe them, here's how I do it. The oldest, you know him, he's the quarterback, he's the leader. My daughter, she's the cheerleader. My third born, he's the kicker. He's the football player. He always get a kick out of Nick. And then Mac, what is Mac? He's the end, Lord willing. Well, let's do one more psalm. Psalm 128 also focuses on the family. For the Jews, their annual pilgrimages to Jerusalem were family affairs. These pilgrimages were family times for the Jews. And Psalm 128 addresses the man or woman who fears the Lord. God blesses such a person. But here's how God blesses a person who fears him. He doesn't necessarily bless him with fame or with fortune, but he blesses him with real riches. He blesses that man at the very heart of his home. God blesses him in the area of life that is most important, his family life. He may not be that successful in business or in the community, but he achieves where it really counts. God blesses the man who fears him at the very heart of his home. Verse 1, blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. When you eat the labor of your hands, you shall be happy and it shall be well with you. And I know men who leave for work every morning and they labor hard for their money and their houses and their cars, but there is no happiness in their life. At home, around the dinner table, there's only tension and animosity and friction. They're at war with their wife. Their kids hate them. There is no happiness at home. And I don't care how much money you have or how many material possessions you accrue in life. If you don't eat and sleep in a happy home, if you don't have happiness around your table, so what? All your success is hollow. The psalmist says of the man who fears the Lord, your wife shall be like a fruitful vine in the very heart of your house, your children like olive plants all around your table. Notice this. His wife is called a fruitful vine. A vine does 3 things. It clings, it climbs, and it clusters. And here's what makes a good wife. She clings to her husband. She gives him attention and affection, time and tenderness. She is submissive to her husband. But then she also climbs spiritually. She doesn't just live for her husband. Oh, no. She pursues a deeper life with God. She stands for Jesus on her own. And lastly, she bears clusters of fruit. Her life is a blessing to others. She yields spiritual fruit. People see traces of God all over her life. And because she clings to her husband, he loves her in return. And because she climbs spiritually, she has her husband's respect. And because she clusters with fruit, he admires her all the more. A good wife is like a fruitful vine. She clings and she climbs and she clusters. And notice he also mentions this man's kids. He says, your children are like olive plants. Now you got to know, an olive tree is not the prettiest looking tree in the orchard. The trunk of an olive tree is gnarled and twisted and knotty. In fact, it takes years of cultivation before an olive tree ever begins to bear olives. But if you're persistent and if you're patient, an olive tree can be extremely productive. And so it is with our kids. We've got to be patient. It takes years to raise that child. We've got to give them time to grow. At times they get gnarly and twisted and ugly, but we've got to be patient with them and we've got to stick with them. You know, the mood in today's society is to push our kids academically and athletically to expect more and more sooner and sooner. A child's character forms early, their talents and their skills mature over time, and so it takes time to raise that child in the way you want him to go. Olive trees are also known for their durability and for their longevity. An olive tree is a rugged plant. In fact, once an olive tree is full grown, it takes very little upkeep and very little nurturing. In fact, you can transplant an olive tree in a different environment and it will still be productive. A mature olive tree is practically indestructible, and this should be the goal for our kids. You want your kids to sink their roots deep into God so that when mom and dad aren't around, they'll still make wise decisions and they'll still want to serve God and they'll still bear fruit pleasing to Him. And even when they're uprooted and placed with a new environment, they'll still have their bearings. They'll still be productive for God. Notice verse 4, "Behold, thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord." You know, I love Psalm 128. It illustrates what I want most out of my life. At the heart of my home, I want a wife who is like a vine, and I want kids who are like olive trees. But you see, here's the frustration. How do you cultivate such a wonderful life? I mean, surely God gives you 10 steps. Surely He lays out the formula. Surely He gives you the blueprints. He tells you what will work. That's not how God does it. Go back to verse 1. God provides us here just two guidelines. He says, fear the Lord and walk in His ways. Here's how you become a man who is blessed at the heart of his home. Here's how you have a fruitful wife, a fruitful vine for a wife, and olive plants for kids. Here's how you do it. You fear the Lord and you walk in His ways. That's the procedure. You put God first in all you do. That's what it means to fear the Lord, to respect Him in all you do, to put Him first. And then you live a biblical life. You honor Him. You walk in His ways. Notice this. He tells us to do two things. Fear the Lord and walk in His ways. Notice what He's doing here. God is addressing the center of my life, and He's addressing the circumference of my life. If I fear and reverence God enough to follow Him, my wife and my kids will respect me enough to follow me. If I look to the Word of God to shape the details of my life, my wife and kids will be inclined to trust in my leadership. At the heart of my home, I fear the Lord. That's the center. At the circumference, I'm walking in God's ways. Every person's circumstances are different. And that's why God doesn't give us a step-by-step plan. But if we let the fear of God govern the center of who we are, and if we let the Word of God rule the circumference of who we are, our lives will line up perfectly, and we'll be blessed people at the very heart of our home. Psalm 128 closes with a blessing. The Lord bless you out of Zion, and may you see the good of Jerusalem all the days of your life. Yes, may you see your children's children. Peace be upon Israel. From March the 10th to the 23rd, I'll be leading a tour to Israel, and we would love for any of our listeners to join us. We'll start at the magnificent theater on the Mediterranean where Paul preached to King Agrippa, and we'll end with worship and communion at the Garden Tomb. In between, it's one exciting adventure after another. Imagine relaxing by the Sea of Galilee one day and floating on the Dead Sea the next, exploring waterfalls in the Golan Heights, and admiring the desert from the top of Masada. We'll spend time in the rock city of Petra and in the holy city of Jerusalem. We'll ride camels, wade through Hezekiah's tunnel, boat across the Sea of Galilee, and study God's Word at every turn. Hey, a trip to Israel is like a Bible study on steroids. If you've never been, I encourage you to go. And if you like, you can go with us. Our trip is affordably priced. If you'd like more details, please contact us. Here's Josh to give you that information.
Thanks, Pastor Sandy. Yes, to learn more about this exciting trip, visit sandyadams.org. Again, this amazing trip is taking place March 10th through the 23rd, 2019. We encourage you to contact the church office at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. You can call us at 770-736-2828 or log on to sandyadams.org. On behalf of Pastor Sandy and the entire production team, it's our prayer that you would seek the Lord about joining Pastor Sandy in Israel in March of 2019.